Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending where you are in the world. Welcome to Helicopter Investor Global. It's amazing what's changed in the month, or a few weeks, 6 weeks, 7 weeks since we had Helicopter Investor in London. Please use the chat screen on the side as much as you like. I see a lot of people have started already. If you want to ask questions, it works better if you ask them in the question function. And then we'll also record your answer so people can see them afterwards. This is available to view afterwards forevermore, or until at least the lockdown's over. And I'm delighted, first of all, let's get on to our first guest. Delighted to have Bill Wolfe. Bill Wolfe needs no introduction. Co-founder, president, and chief executive of Lobo Leasing, 30 years experience in helicopters. He was a banker before he became a lessor. Bill, what are you seeing at the moment?
Well, first of all, Al, thanks for having me, and thanks for organizing this gathering. I'm going to run through very quickly, and then happy to take questions or wait till later in the program for questions. But we're going to just make some observations from Lobo's perspective on what we call from the helicopter leasing trenches. The early signs of spring, and I mean that metaphorically, that we were all seeing in the helicopter space when we all gathered in Anaheim for Heli Expo and we gathered in London at the end of February, have been replaced by uncertain havoc, and the key word being uncertain. I'm going to start with just some few observations about demand and on the activity side. Not surprisingly, it's not just about oil and gas. The demand dislocation that we're seeing is in most but not all sectors, and it's changing fast. So as soon as we sort of calibrate this, we're getting new information, and it's moving mostly in a downward direction. But let me just run through some of the subsectors to share some data and anecdotes. In the oil and gas side, we're seeing 20 to 30% immediate reductions in flying. Now, that's not all regions, and it's not all activity levels. So let me peel into that just a little bit briefly. First of all, some regions are not experiencing a reduction in flying hours. Brazil is the most notable about that. We think this is a good example of the difference between international oil companies and national oil companies, where oil is strategic to Brazil and Brazil is going to defend that space and is continuing activity more broadly than in other areas where we're seeing greater than 20 to 30% reduction in flying hours. It's also obviously not all activity. We've seen rapid cancellation of early developmental drilling programs, but production activity is continuing. Interestingly, and not surprisingly, most offshore oil is natural flowing oil. Some of it is obviously pumped in enhanced recovery, but most of it is natural flowing oil. It is much more expensive and difficult to shut off naturally flowing oil wells than it is enhanced recovery and pumping wells, which tend to be more onshore. And so a lot of activity is slowing, not cutting off, because of the damage it will do to the production capacity. Shifting quickly to general utility, it's mixed, but it's also generally deeply impacted, similar to oil and gas. Just some anecdotes there. Maritime pilot transfers are down dramatically when there aren't a lot of container ships being shipped out of China and other exporting countries. You don't need pilot transfers, so a lot of pilot transfer activity is down. Offshore wind turbines, also interestingly counterintuitive to us, when natural gas is cheaper on an inflation-adjusted basis than it's been in decades, it is cheaper to generate power off of natural gas than it is to repair offshore wind turbines. We've seen reduced flying in offshore wind turbines. Again, another somewhat counterintuitive example of reduced flying hours in general utility is offshore diamond mining. It's not that necessarily that industrial diamond demand and decorative diamond demand is down, which they are, but production and finishing facilities are shut down in countries where the diamonds get finished, and so offshore diamond mining is down. Other sectors, construction support off significantly, again, not surprisingly. Firefighting, it's seasonal, so we expect it to be largely unaffected, and the fire season is just getting underway in the U.S., so we will see, but in other areas, it's continued. Search and rescue, completely unaffected. We've seen no reduction in that, again, not surprising. EMS and parapublic activity, unaffected to the best of our observation so far, and in some cases, actually increased flying. And the final sector, which we do not participate in and don't have greater visibility on, is VIP, but just general flying seems like that sector is off. The biggest observation we'd make is how much uncertainty is out there and the inability of operators to project what's going to happen. And I think this is obviously true for most industries, but it's rampant here. They can't tell what's going on or what's going to happen. The second big observation we'll make besides the demand dislocation that I ran through quickly is many operators need immediate cash flow relief. We have heard from a meaningful number of our lessees who've asked for short-term payment relief. That's not surprising because they see uncertainty coming, but some of them are actually almost immediately facing short-term cash flow dislocation because of the decline in flight hours and or payments from their end customers who have slowed down payments. They've also obviously seen short-term cancellations of activity and are concerned about longer-term cancellations in addition. What's interesting now versus a couple of years ago, and obviously this is true of the big players in terms of the operators, but it's also true of smaller operators, with debt capital either previously restructured into equity and or debt providers now slow or reticent to provide additional capital right now, lease costs are one of the few levers that operators actually have available in their capital structure that they can go ask for relief for. Our analysis, and others may have taken a different approach on this, is it is much a lower cost to restructure for a short-term lease relief than it is to force intermediate liquidity problems or insolvency issues. So in other words, it's better to give that relief. Just a few other separate observations. First of all, government policy is having immediate impact in the helicopter sector. In Brazil, the government's intention and explicit statements about supporting activity and supporting the critical to the economy and oil and gas industry has been critical, and it's resulting in confidence in that sector that you're not seeing in other places. In the U.S., several operators have been able to avail themselves of the payroll protection program, the PPP, and receive cash flow, which for 8 to 12 weeks at least will allow them to be liquid and avoid layoffs. On a case-by-case basis, we have found ways to support lessees facing revenue shocks. Not surprisingly, given where we operate globally, we're already set up well for working remotely. Customer contact obviously is much more difficult, including most specifically physical inspections, which we've had to put on hold for a period of time, given travel restrictions and or just pure concerns about everyone's health and safety on our end and on the customer's end. And remote negotiations, which we've had an incredible number of since the lockdown started 8 weeks approximately ago, are very difficult and less effective in person, but we're getting them done. We're getting requests for financing for additional equipment, which is interesting to us, but much more so we're getting requests for sale and leaseback financing, but we're finding that those are going to be very challenging to implement. Longer term, and just to obviously try and look beyond the horizon, which is looks stormy to all of us at this point, leasing helicopters is now a well-established part of the helicopter industry ecosystem. All operators think about leasing now, even on long-term government contracts. Perversely, the health-related shocks like COVID-19 may make helicopters more in demand in the long term for more isolated transportation and obviously for EMS. As the downturn that we were all in for years and when things were just starting to look better, what we hope will be the silver lining that will come out of this, that this will further instill, because we think it was already there, but the much needed investment discipline in helicopter markets. Obviously, growth for growth's sake was shown to be dangerous, and the current downturn reinforces that. We're looking forward to the further maturation of the helicopter investment market. We don't think this will ever be a market where it's just a, you know, quote unquote, healthy market where all logical participants make a reasonable return on investment. We think that that is a fantasy, and we think that this crisis makes that ever more clear because chaos tends to prevail over order, and goodness knows we've had lots of chaos in the helicopter leasing industry since its inception 8 to 10 years ago, depending on how you measure it. And so, again, the final good note about investment in helicopters is with discipline now, there will be now and in the future opportunities to make good investment returns. But the key ingredients are careful deal selection, really thoughtful structuring, and a strong active lease management and servicing. So we're left with just lots and lots of questions, and I'll just state a few of these and then close and turn it back over to Alistair. But the questions that we're asking ourselves, and we'd be interested in thoughts from this forum and others, is, will government budgets for EMS helicopters increase as a result of this crisis? It seems like an obvious one that that health infrastructure is under implemented, certainly even in the developing world, but most notably in the undeveloped world as well. Will oil and gas companies reconsider the types and ages of helicopters in order to maximize cost reductions in a sub $40 a barrel oil environment? Will social distancing be applied on oil and gas flights, and who will pay for the extra cost seat and mile? Will it just be cheaper to have oil workers wear full personal protective gear? And then finally, will oil companies support more M&A of oil and gas operators in order to reduce lower costs? And will they stop their historic practice of creating competition to drive the cost down? So more questions than answers. Obviously, the early reports, and it is early, this is the emphasis we want to place on this, is what we're seeing on the demand dislocation side is changing hourly, if not daily. So that's our quick observations from the trenches. Alistair, back to you.
Thanks, Bill. There's a lot to pick up on there. And we've got questions coming from the audience. Richard Birkemeyer, who's speaking later, is asking, what are the opportunities, or do you see a new round of bankruptcies, mergers, et cetera, which can be opportunities?
Yeah, absolutely. Our view is, and we're watching this very carefully, and our leasing partners that we're active with are feeding us information real time, and we appreciate the transparency they're offering us. Most of them have the ability to avoid making dramatic decisions like a restructuring for months. But if the current activity levels continue, we think there are going to be increased bankruptcies, and we think there's going to be forced consolidation as a result, because a lot of them have already pulled the switches and levers that allow for a bankruptcy restructuring. They've already got their fleet down to reasonable amount. They've made a lot of cuts before. And so if the end customer is going to stop paying, and I'm talking mostly about the oil and gas sector, but I think this is going to apply to other sectors. We think lessees, which are now a more meaningful part of the capital structure, are going to be faced with making choices about whether we become lessors, rather about whether we're going to become equity holders. So yes, we see restructuring on the horizon, but if reopening is starting to happen and if cash flow starts moving again, there's a chance we can avoid some of them. But there's going to be dislocation and restructuring.
One of the, this is a downturn that you've mentioned that the helicopter market's been in for a long time. One of the big differences this time is that when you were going to lenders or lessors were going to lenders and operators were going to lenders, helicopters were sort of a unique basket case at the time. Now they've got huge problems. You know, a lot of lenders also lend to commercial aviation. Is it going to be much harder now to get the attention and also the goodwill?
Well, I guess there's two sides to that coin. Alistair, first of all, yes, it's going to be hard to get their attention. I'm sure a lot of people on this call know people at the large money center banks and just to not quote them directly and mention a name, but having spoken to a banker at a major international bank saying, the helicopter sector now is my favorite problem because it's a much smaller problem. And so you point out that, we went from being the poster child industry for difficult aviation leasing. We now look pretty good in comparison to fixed wing. So yes, it will be hard to get their attention. But we are small problems compared to what they're going to be facing. And, in terms of the issues. And I suspect, that banks are going to be interested in making, quick, decisions in the areas that they can and make quick accommodations. But we'll see. The folks that we know in the banking sector have just literally said, we'll be back to you when we're done solving some of the initial problems we're having on the fixed wing side, because those are just myriad and are going to be much more complex and much more dramatic in terms of scale.
There's a question from David Martin. Is there still a fundamental misalignment of end user contract terms versus asset finance terms?
Well, yes, David, you're preaching to the choir on that with that question, and the answer is resoundingly yes. And And you know, will a restructuring like this force the end customers to actually realize that they cannot play this sector off itself, and it's at the point of where they're going to hurt themselves and there's going to be safety issues? We've all been hoping against hope that the end customer will realize that. And in normal course scenarios, it tends to be where, you know, why would they? They can force their provider, their vendor to lower cost, and it doesn't seem to affect them. Maybe in this instance, where it becomes an existence level event for a lot of their suppliers, that they will actually now restructure. That's a hope, but it's when the tide goes out, real structural issues get exposed, and you just mentioned the number one biggest issue in offshore oil and gas.
There's a question from Richard Berkemeyer. Leasing companies that are diversified seem to be in reasonable shape.
So repeat that again. I missed the middle part of your question.
Are diversified leasing companies in reasonable shape?
So the answer is yes. Leasing companies, and I'll make a shout out to my good friend Olivia Pio, to leasing companies who are majority in EMS, like Nova Capital is. That they are in the best place you could possibly be. So if you're undiversified and in EMS, you are not to give Olivier a guilt about being a survivor here, but that's the best place to be. But obviously, if you're in search and rescue, and if you're outside of oil and gas, and if you're in EMS, you're going to be doing better. But other sectors, and that's why I wanted to mention some of those anecdotes about pilot transfer, wind farm, other general sectors, those are profoundly impacted as well. It's not just about oil and gas this time. So I'm going to kind of flip that a little bit. I think diversification will help you because oil and gas is probably going to be some of the most dramatically impacted again. But unless that diversification is dramatically in EMS, it's going to be challenging.
Again, I don't want to ask you too many questions, but there's one from Gerard de Tern at Airbus. Should we expect an even worse excess capacity, i.e. a helicopter fleet bigger than what is really needed?
Well, I love where that question's coming from. And so if our friends at the OEMs will continue what they've been doing, and they've been heroic about slowing down production and keeping new equipment out, which I know is not what they want to do, but we do think that excess capacity will be reabsorbed. Right now, in the short term, a lot of aircraft are on the ground, and so from our perspective, it's going to be longer. We were working our way through it. Certain helicopter types and certain specific models were in much better supply and demand shape, and hopefully those won't get too terribly out of balance. But right now, the balance is swinging the wrong way. And as long as there's OEM discipline, which again, we thank you all for restraining the sales and production side, we can work through it. But short term, we're seeing a lot of aircraft sitting on the ground in different regions of the world.
Okay, Bill, that's great. Any rays of sunshine?
Alistair, the only ray of sunshine, and I mentioned this as I ran through the high level summary I went through, is our industry has mostly gone through an incredibly painful, cathartic restructuring. And so the ray of sunshine is we've been in the hurricane for a while. And so, maybe the wind's speed has picked up a little bit. Maybe it's going to be lasting a little bit longer. But people have made a lot of hard decisions previously in restructuring. So the ray of sunshine is the rest of the world was doing quite well. And now they're facing the hurricane that we've been in for a while. And so we had the hatches battened down. Let's just keep them battened down for a while and see how we do.
Bill Wolf, President and CEO of Lobo Leasing, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alistair.
Thanks. Okay, Bill talked about a painful, cathartic restructuring process. We're delighted to have someone who enjoys painful, cathartic restructuring processes. Hooman Yazari, former CEO of Waypoint Leasing, current lead independent director of Bristow Helicopters. We talk about painful restructurings. Before Waypoint, he was senior vice president legal and administration for CHC. Before that, Gate Group, the airline catering group, and ILFC. Hooman, how are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm given everything that's going on in the world and all the all the difficulties that we're facing as a society, we're blessed and we're good. Thank you. I hope everyone else on the phone is as well.
That's good. And how are you viewing the helicopter market now?
You know, just a few opening remarks, Alistair. First of all, I just wanted to tell everyone here, I'm seeing all the names and all the messages, and I wanted to tell everyone how keen I am to see everyone in person again, give them a hug or a handshake or a fist bump or whatever we're going to do post-corona, and for this to be over. But it seems to me like it's going to take a while before our world goes back to the new normal, and I don't think it'll be the old normal. The other point, thank you for the introduction. I'm speaking as Who Man rather than as a board member of Bristow. So please don't attribute my comments to the corporation or the board of Bristow. In terms of your question of how I see the market, you know, I find the coronavirus has been an incredible metaphor for many things that have been happening both in our society and in our markets. An accelerator and a source of light shining onto problems that we should all have been running towards rather than running away from over the last few years. I think if you think about the pillars of our industry, right, the operators, the OEMs, the leasing companies, the end customer, the oil and gas, we've had problems, and Bill was kind enough to point all this stuff out, but we've had issues in terms of overcapacity, in terms of the business model, in terms of being rewarded for risk, in terms of our flexibility as operators, et cetera. And all of those were salami sliced, as it were, over the last 4 or 5 years, and then some big machetes with the Chapter 11s that we had. But the fundamental problems weren't fixed, right? So if you take each of those constituents, I think operators needed to start consolidating years ago. And the lower oil price and the lower demand and the disruptions and the lack of financing that's going to come to this market because of the global issues with financing that Bill just pointed out, I think will accelerate that requirement to continue to consolidate and to get some kind of control over the capacity that we have. The other thing the operators, I think, can do, and the point of diversification came across earlier, is just that, right? If you focus your core skill, which is flying and operating helicopters safely, to other areas of operations, and whether it's adjacencies like wind turbines, or it's something completely crazy like urban air mobility, the operators have this core skill, which I think should be used for other things. So that when oil and gas continues its ups and downs, like the terrible roller coaster that it is, there's some built-in resilience in what the operators do in terms of their own business model. Operators have been asking to have the flexibility to work more like an airline so that they don't have to come up with the exact specification of the aircraft and do so at the bidding of the customer. And the handcuffs on the operators, not allowing them to just show up with a helicopter that is proven and safe and fit for mission, rather than modified to the extent that the end customer requires, and for safety reasons, of course, does not allow the operator to create the efficiency of its own service. Certain flight times require us to have two crews at the operator level instead of one crew. Inefficiency, which again the price has to be paid for by someone, and I think there's a whole slew of things that the operators could do in addition to consolidate and diversify to create that efficiency in their own business, which the end customers need to work hand in glove with the operators to do, right? And if you go on to the OEMs, not to make myself unpopular with them, but you need, for the OEMs and for the industry and for the technology and for the financiers to have something to do, you need new helicopters to come into the market, right? But when you already have too many, perhaps the OEMs can think of residual value guarantees for new aircraft that they're selling to the lessors, or there's some kind of buyback, or there's some kind of industry way of getting rid of that excess capacity. The drill ship industry has, I think, an interesting way of getting rid of old ships and dismantling them. The helicopter market is new to that, or the longevity of these assets doesn't really lend itself to people parting stuff out. And now that we have a reduction in flight hours, I think that part out value is even lower because the spare parts are probably not as needed as they were a few months ago. So we have a challenge as an industry, which we, together with the OEMs, need to understand how we bypass, right? And then if you think about the oil companies making sure that what the management says about wanting strong, safe, efficient operators is also seen at the procurement level, so that when the operators do go to bid for things, they are given terms which allow them to in turn go and finance their balance sheets, get paid for the risk and the long-term capital investments that they're making, allow them to have that freedom of operation so that they can pass the costs and the efficiencies onto the customer. And then we come to the lessors, and you know, Bill, I think, showed the enlightened self-interest that the lessors can display here, which is to play along and help and support their customers. And I think you're right, Bill. I think when a leasing company is faced with customers who need help, you have to help. The alternative is you lose and alienate your customers, or they go bankrupt. They come back to you stronger with a weapon of Chapter 11, which they can wave in your face. The other things that we need to figure out with the leasing companies is how do we strengthen them to ensure that they continue to be a source of capital for this industry that needs a ton of capital. What is their business model? How do you align the leasing companies with the operators? When you have a shrinking of the number of aircraft that you need, the incentives of the lessors somewhat end up being against those of the operators, right? So you give your aircraft back to the leasing company, and it's sitting there burning a hole on their balance sheet so they can throw it back into a market that's already oversaturated at a lower price. And that makes life for the operators extremely difficult because that encourages that downward price spiral that we've seen in the market. So how do you align the lessors not to continue that continued downward spiral of pricing is something that I think we as an industry need to sit down and discuss. The business model also is interesting because the leasing companies have reasonable balance sheets, and certainly the ones that sit on much bigger organizations like Macquarie and GE to a certain extent have a balance sheet that would certainly outshine that of many of the operators. And then you've got a wonderful balance sheet on the oil company side, assuming that, you know, they continue their strength that they have now. But then the operator is the weaker credit in the middle, which ends up bringing in a financing inefficiency in that chain, right? So is it right for lessors to lease to an operator who then onwardly provides that aircraft to a leasing company, oil company? Or should the lessors lease directly to the oil companies and allow the operators to be asset light and therefore not require a balance sheet and therefore be able to be, again, more efficient, more variable in their cost base, and focus on what they're good at doing, which is the operational side of it rather than the financing and balance sheet side of it, so that we can continue with the most efficient way of providing our services with the utmost safety. So some thoughts that honestly had been in my head for years, and I suspect that when the coronavirus stopwatch has accelerated some of these requirements, needs, trends, urgencies, and risks to our industry, I think we as an industry all need to get around the table, and instead of trying to outrun the bear and hoping the bear catches your friend that runs a little bit slower than you, that we all turn around shoulder to shoulder, face that bear, and make sure that it doesn't hurt the industry anymore.
I love the running at the bear analogy. One of the problems you've had, which you've had firsthand, is when you're in a company that's suddenly lost cash flow from customers, you know, debts are mounting, cash burn is high, it's really hard time to go, this is our new business, or let's go and talk about a merger, isn't it? How do executives, operators find the time to go, this is the time to go off into a completely new area when, you know, all they're getting is bad news?
You know, it's a good question. I think leadership is all about having the right vision and inspiring your stakeholders, including your team members, but your customers, suppliers, shareholders.
I've lost lenders. You. Hey,
you. Can you hear me now?
I've lost you sound-wise. Okay, I can hear you now.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Sorry.
What I was saying was, I think leadership is tough, right? So what you need to do is to make sure that you as a leader have a vision and are able to inspire those around you, whether it's your own team members, your suppliers, your customers, your financiers, your board, to come with you to achieve that vision in a way which is value add for everybody in that stakeholder group, right? And I find that when you are in times of distress, it's very difficult to focus on the big picture, as you said, Alistair, right? Because you've got fires that are burning in front of your face. But unless a leader bifurcates and ensures that those fires are being dealt with, but is building the bridge towards a new reality, there's no point putting those fires out and then finding yourself back in the next door frying pan, right? So I think that the any leader in any of these stakeholder groups that we've talked about who has the vision for the next iteration of their business, and this goes way beyond the helicopter market, right? Because if you think about the business disruption that we're having as a society with Corona, I think every business has to think about what's their new reality. How are they going to get their product to their customers at a price that the customer actually can afford or wants? But in our own industry, I think that keeping an eye on the big picture, and I encourage all the stakeholders to work together in as close a way as possible, like we do on safety. But to think about how do we do that level of cooperation on the survival of this industry as a healthy and efficient one, at the same time as all of us putting out the little fires that are starting and probably will get bigger and bigger as the industry goes on.
Okay, I've got a question for you from Kuldeep Yadav. Some oil and gas companies are asking operators to reduce the price of current contracts. Should leasing companies take rental cuts to support the same? Did you hear me, human? Did you get that?
Could you repeat the question? Some oil and gas companies are
asking operators to reduce the price of current contracts. Should leasing companies take rental cuts to support the same? Okay, I've lost you. Hi, human. I think we've lost you. Can you hear me? Wait a second. It's so temperamental. I think your sound's gone off when you changed the headphones. Your mute button's on. Okay. Okay, wait, it's coming back on. Okay. What we're going to do is, Hugh, I'm going to go away for a second and come back. Okay, sorry, guys. Crowdcast is fantastic. But for some reason, it wouldn't let me unmute human, and I promise I hadn't muted him in the first place. So what I'll do is I'll invite him back on, and it should work this time, fingers crossed. It's probably a bird landing on our power line outside. Right. I can hear you.
Now I'm unmuted.
Great. I don't know what happened there. So great to have you back.
Thank you for having me back. Look, I think yes, the oil companies are going to ask for discounts, and yes, the lessors are going to think very hard about giving those discounts, and I think they should. However, for the leasing companies to be sustainable, they can't continue to give those discounts so that you deteriorate in their own cash flows and ultimately the residual values of their own aircraft as they're yielding less return. So yes, short term, I think the lessors need to help. The problem then becomes, how do you make this a long-term sustainable solution? And I think that some of the other points of a more holistic cooperative approach with the operators and the OEMs and the oil and gas companies and the leasing companies and frankly the lenders to those leasing companies is the only way that we can come to a stable business, even in the face of a $20 barrel oil.
Okay, that's a great answer. Being optimistic, if you have capital, is now the time to invest in the helicopter industry?
The helicopter industry is a big place, even though it's not as big as the fixed wing, which Bill rightly pointed out. I would think that there are pockets of strength in each one of those stakeholders that we just talked about, right? Certain operators are more levered than others. Certain operators are more profitable than others. Certain assets may be available to pick up even more cheaply than one could have before, as long as one has the view that these are assets that are going to be here for the long term. And I think there are certain providers of capital will be incredibly spoiled for choice because we will be needing capital and you know, it'll become more and more scarce, not just given the difficulties that this industry faces, but given the industry difficulties faced in the sister industry of the fixed wing aviation market and also the oil and gas market too. So look, I think whoever has that capital can start to find wonderful opportunities. But if you think about the curve of the coronavirus and whether you believe in the V-shaped recovery or the U-shaped recovery or the L-shaped pain or the bathtub-shaped recovery, I suspect we're still at the beginning of the phase of prices continuing to look better and better. So I would probably be patiently looking at all the opportunities with my own capital and waiting for a few months.
Thanks so much, Human. So that was Human Yazari, former CEO of Waypoint, and not speaking in his role as lead director of Bristow. Thank you very much, Human. Great talking.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we're delighted now to have Emmanuel Dupuy. Needs no introduction. If you want to buy a helicopter, this is your man. Emmanuel's been selling fixed and rotary aircraft since 2004, and he's sales director of Aero Asset. Emmanuel, what are you seeing?
Hi, Alan. Thanks for having me on. And might I say you look very fine today. I was going to go for the castaway look very early in the confinement. You know, Tom Hanks stranded on his desert island, but figured it probably wouldn't give the right impression. Anyway,
I just love the paneling in the background. Will we get to see your butler bringing you afternoon tea in a minute?
I wish. I mean, in addition to trading helicopters, Aero Asset reports what it sees on the market and to clients, and also in its quarterly report, which we release publicly. So just very briefly, let's recap 2019. We saw continued improvements in most pre-owned markets. We saw a reduction in absorption rate to below 2 years of supply at 2019 trade levels. We saw an increase in sales volume through Q4. In our last quarterly report, it's called the Heli Market Trends, we looked at how Q1 2020 compared to the 2019 quarterly average. And we reported that overall pre-owned supply available for sale was stable, absorption rate was stable, and actually, overall, twin pre-owned sales were up just under 10%. So 10% more units retailed Q1 versus 2019 quarterly average. However, if we compared the same unit sales quarter over quarter, we see 40% less units retailed Q1 2020 compared to Q1 19. So on one hand, Q1 2019 quarterly average conditions were stable. On one hand, Q1 versus 2019 quarterly average conditions were stable, even slightly improving. On the other hand, quarter over quarter, we saw a significant drop in units sold. So which of these two trends will continue Q2 and Q3? That's the $150 million question. In addition to this, the slowdown, which started pre-COVID and oil crash, of the amount of deals pending at various stages of transaction continued throughout Q1. So the number of pre-owned deals pending, which is a great measure of closings to come, declined 20% quarter on quarter and 40% since Q3 2019. So how are we doing Q2? We're mid-quarter. Let's extrapolate and presume we sustain the current performance. So if the second half of Q2 resembles the first half, for the third consecutive quarter, overall supply will have increased to mid-2018 levels. Overall sales will be down 40% compared to Q2 19. Absorption rate will be up north of 3 years versus Q1. And lastly, the amount of deals in the pipeline will be 50% less than Q2 2019.
So you're expecting this quarter, Q2, to be a disaster. How much of that is due to people not wanting assets versus people not being able to transact, not being able to get the helicopter for somewhere for a post-purchase inspection, or you know, actually deliver one, move it around the world?
Yeah, I think for both reasons, for sure. It takes time for pricing to adjust to a new situation. And I think it's very important that owners are realistic about market conditions. Since COVID and oil crash, we reduced pricing on 7 out of 12 of the exclusive listings we have for sale right now. And we provided intel to our clients who in turn elected to reduce asking prices and you know, keep their edge on the market. But I tell you, Al, we've got action on all our listings right now. So, you know, there's interaction, there's offers, there's negotiation, there's even PPI planning, which is subject to travel restrictions. So not to say that conditions aren't difficult, they really are, but to all who are listening and feeling, you know, the blues, remember that you'll either find a way or make one.
That's a nice and uplifting. Question from Sharon McKenna. Will there be a boom in business exec usage, people who are using a helicopter rather than commercial or chartering?
I mean, there may be, but I think the takeaway from analyzing all this data and getting ready for this call is that we're not seeing the impact on the market yet, and we have to be a little more patient and brace for the end of Q2 and Q3. And I think when companies start publishing their results, especially Q3, where we may see a mindset change in the VIP market, where you know the helicopter in the VIP segment may be replaceable by a lesser transportation mode, a lesser cost.
Okay, that's great. Question from Charlotte Pedersen at Lux Aviation. In the VVIP sector, clients would be interested in leasing if leasing terms would be shorter, such as 3 years. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, some owners who are belly up in their book values may, come Q3 or Q4, may be interested to look into a short-term lease of their VIP asset. I mean, I think that makes sense. I think a lot of the high net worth, like the VVIP owners, you know, may not feel as much of the crunch as some of the, let's say, less fortunate, but nonetheless very fortunate owners.
Okay, you're obviously reliant on helicopter transactions for your business. What are you guys doing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we've got stuff going on. I mean, it's surprising actually. We have calls every week with a sales team. And every week we surprise ourselves. There's interaction, there's offers, there's negotiations going on, there's PPI planning. It's all subject to the travel restrictions, the borders are closed. It's very difficult to move around. You have to find inspectors within the boundaries of the country where the asset is, or at least the buyers have to find inspectors. So nothing's easy, but there's definitely, we're seeing action in the marketplace.
Okay, and another question from Kuldeep Yadav. During the COVID-19 situation, which kind of sellers or buyers are coming to the pre-owned market? Are you expecting to see or seeing more private owners or commercial or oil and gas operators who wish to sell or buy?
That's a great question. We haven't seen any in the oil and gas market. We haven't seen any influx of aircraft for sale. So, oil and gas helicopter markets were not affected by the previous crisis. So, for example, in the S-76 C plus market, we still have a oversupply of oil and gas aircraft for sale. But this said, we haven't seen a mass influx of oil and gas configured machine on the pre-owned market. We haven't seen an influx of VIP aircraft on the pre-owned market either, nor EMS. But what we have seen is a demand for EMS aircraft, which had been very strong before COVID, really dwindled. And talking to a lot of the EMS operators in the US and also in Europe, we heard that their flight hour were down between 25 and 40%. And we had been involved in a few deals, EMS deals prior COVID, which all basically went into ultra slow motion. Actually, one just collapsed, but the other is really in slow motion. I'm not sure it's going to survive.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks so much. Really appreciate having you on. That was Manuel Dupuis, sales director of Aero Asset from his Normandy Chateau.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks. Now delighted to have another person who really likes data. It's great to have Steve Robertson on board. While Emmanuel tracks helicopter sales and helicopter sales and transactions, Steve is your man if you want to know anything about offshore activity. 17 years as an energy sector research and consultant, and he formed R&C Analytics last year. Steve, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Very well, Al. Thank you, first of all, for putting this on. I think this is fantastic, and I'm sure I'll speak on behalf of everybody for saying this is something we've really missed in the downturn, is this interaction between us all. So thank you very much for putting this on. But yeah, no, we're all very well. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, and I think everyone appreciates your background picture.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was a wife's idea, actually, believe it or not. She thought you'd probably take the mickey out of my steam train pictures otherwise. So that's kind of covering that up. There you go.
And she was right. Yeah. So, Steve, what's going on? What you know, you've got amazing data. What are you seeing?
Well, look, yeah, that's the reason for starting this business was to try and measure demand in a as precise as possible quantitative way, by tracking flight activity rather than measuring the drivers of demand. So I mean, look, it's, I think when we met last time, we were seeing some indicators of growth in the market. We were seeing that utilization of aircraft was improving, and you know, clearly in the last 2 months that's all been turned on its head. As of April, compared to the year before, for the last couple of weeks of April, activity for super medium and heavy aircraft, like the S-92 behind me, is down 29% globally. Now, there's some regional nuances in that. There's some parts of the world where rig activity has been fairly stable in terms of the production rigs and the drilling rigs. If you look at places like Norway, between March and April, for the mobile drilling rigs, there was 14 rigs operating in March. There's still 14 operating in April. If you look at places like the UK, that number for mobile rigs has fallen from 6 to 4. If you look at the US, it's gone down from, I think, 22 to 18. And that's having a corresponding effect on flight activity, as is demanning of platforms or reduced banning of platforms. And in some cases, of course, platforms have been shut in altogether. So that's, you know, this is a cyclical industry, and I think it always will be a cyclical industry, and there'll be opportunities throughout the cycle. But the comparison with 2016, you know, my view is that coming into 2015 and 2016, we'd had 4 years of record levels of investment in, you know, upstream oil and gas, and that had flown through the supply chain to the benefit, you know, arguably of most of the players in that market. You know, the challenge we've got now is that, you know, we just haven't had that benefit of the kind of the you know, that period of growth before this downturn. And this really is an unprecedented downturn now, because we've got the combination of, you know, a global pandemic with a you know, with an oil price downturn, you know, that's of a magnitude we really haven't seen for decades. So look, that's going to be tough for the industry, and it would be wrong to pretend it's going to be anything otherwise.
So today, the Financial Times had a headline that the CEO of BP is saying this might be peak oil. Does any part of you think we may have had peak offshore?
It's very difficult to say. I don't necessarily believe so. I think we've got so many projects that are coming up, and I track all of those, and there's hundreds of them, and some of them are very large indeed, and some of those will bring on stream, yeah, hundreds of barrels a day of production capacity at a time. So you've got to think about it when you're thinking about peak oil. On one hand, you've got the existing production capacity, which declines obviously as the pressure in the reservoirs goes down, and then you've got additional new capacity coming on stream. If you look at where the capacity is coming off at the moment, it's not really offshore. There's a little bit here and there, Brazil, other parts of the world, but where the capacity is coming off very quickly is in some of the OPEC producers, and fundamentally in North America, where your break-even costs are very high. You know, at, you know, $20 a barrel, you know, really no one's making any money, and they're shutting in the wells pretty quick. So I think in terms of the pain, I think we're going to see, from a production perspective, we're going to see onshore, some of the high-cost onshore. So that's Canada, that's unconventional US take the pain first. You know, going forward, whether we're at peak or not just depends how far that, you know, upcoming portfolio of projects offshore gets pushed to the right and extended out. I think, you know, right at this minute, it's difficult to see a V-shaped recovery. It's very difficult to see oil prices coming back to the levels that are going to trigger project sanctioning. So from an E&P perspective, you know, they're going to be hanging on to cash, they're going to be cancelling any non-essential expenditure from an operations perspective. You know, any unsanctioned capex, with a few exceptions, is being cancelled already. And we've seen, you know, for the main companies that work in the offshore market, you know, $50, $60 billion already of capex cuts. So I think, you know, potentially it's going to be, you know, the onshore market's feeling the pain from a production perspective first, and then whether we see peak or not is purely a function of how long it takes for that offshore project sanctioning to come back, which, you know, at the moment it's impossible to predict, because we can't say what the oil price is going to be in, you know, 3 weeks' time, let alone 3 months' time or 3 years' time. But we're going to need oil price to recover to $40, $50 a barrel to see those projects start to move again.
So there's a poll up at the moment. Can offshore energy companies expect further discounts from operators? And, you know, a few 11% have said yes, they'll get less than 10%. 40% have said they've already given, 75% have said they've already given everything they can. Do you see there's the opportunity for, you know, oil and gas majors to cut helicopter operating costs? I guess there's crew rotations, so you could cut those.
Yeah, there's crew rotations, which in some cases had gone back to some of the previous 2-week off cycles. I think the extent of where the market's moved from where it was is material. I think, you know, the market was clearly struggling in a number of areas prior to this downturn. I think we'll see the market emerge in very different shape from what it is now out of this crisis, and that's going to be a very difficult story clearly from a number of perspectives. But I think, as has been said already today, that will bring with it its own opportunities. But there's got to be some fundamental restructuring and reorganization of the offshore helicopter operator business for it to be sustainable, because there's no way it can survive in its current state.
And on that cheery note,
sorry,
give us something to be optimistic about. Nothing.
Well, look, I think there's an enormous amount of very impressive work that's been done in this industry in a very short period of time to enable the industry to continue going, just to continue operating on a day-to-day basis. And that is a huge credit to the people that have been delivering that activity, spinning so many plates to make that happen. So, I think when you look at the industry, you can say, for sure, this is a remarkable industry. This is a very adaptable industry, and it will adapt again to the commercial challenges that it's facing. And, like I said right at the beginning of this, it's a cyclical market, and we've seen these cycles come to the market multiple times in the last two decades. We're going into another one, which is going to be challenging, but it will emerge from this, and we'll see this industry come back to a healthy state at some point in the future.
And that's as optimistic as I'm going to get from you, Steve. So thanks very much. Brilliant. Amazing data, as always. Thanks so much, Steve Robertson, founder of Air&C Analytics. Thanks, Steve.
Cheers. Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, there's no pressure, but when you're looking to, we now have a group of appraisers and valuers coming up, and when you're looking at them to cheer you up, you're in trouble. Sarah, what are you seeing at the moment?
I think about that every time you've asked that question, Alistair, today. What are we seeing is so much is very difficult to summarise in a 10-minute session, but I think it's been done pretty well so far. Firstly, thank you very much for including us in this session here and for organising the forum. What are we seeing? I think it's important to divide the market into the segments that we've been talking about previously. So we're currently looking at offshore, parapublic, and corporate VIP as three different segments with three different drivers. I also think it's quite important to look at long-term versus short-term issues. And we do have a double whammy at the moment with the low oil prices combined with COVID-19 that is putting pressure on ultimate demand for oil. And it's worth recognising that is largely anticipated to be a short-term thing. Whilst the OPEC and the oil price war could drag on. So it's very difficult to summarize that. I think offshore is as volatile as it's ever been. We've seen parapublic sectors largely behaving the way we expect. And I have some fear for the corporate VIP sector would we go into a thought recession towards the end of this year. And I believe that recession is thought to be quite severe. And we've seen before how that affects the corporate VIP sector. Now, there's not much as much investable assets in the corporate VIP sector, so it's likely to affect large financial institutions and investors. But in saying that, it could have the effect whereby we've seen a lot of excess capacity going to corporate and VIP. And obviously, if that route is closed for machines that are no longer needed in the primary sector, then that could cause an issue. as for values, they are on watch, obviously, but it's very, very difficult to make any sound judgment at this moment in time. As Emmanuel said, we haven't seen availability climb as much as one would expect, but that might have its reasons. there's obviously very little trade going on as well. There is some, but largely those that were sort of in the making before COVID-19. So everything's on watch, and I think it's going to be a flurry of activity once the market starts going again.
When do you think appraisers will be able to value, give a valuation?
We value now. We haven't stopped our values. We look at a range of different parameters, which is not just sale price. It also incorporates availability, demand, shifting trends within certain sectors. And that's the kind of thing that we're monitoring at the moment. But for us at Ascend by Cerium, we value stability over choppy movements or short-term movements. So we want to make sure that it's the right move for the right reasons. I've lost you, Alistair. I can't actually hear you.
Sorry, I'm toggling too much. Are you doing?
There you go.
Are you including disclaimers on valuations? Going, you know, this is an odd market.
Lost you again.
Have you lost me again? Okay.
You might have to repeat that, Alistair. I didn't hear you.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? No, you can't hear me now. Okay, sorry, I think you've lost me, but Bill Wolf's got me. I'm going to take you off and bring you back on now, if that's okay.
I can't hear Alistair, so if somebody can write down his question, then that would be useful.
I'll come back to you. Sorry, I'll come back and I'll bring you back in. I think I was trying to be too clever. What we're going to do now is try and see how many appraisers we can get speaking at one time, and also see if we can get the impossibility of appraisers agreeing on a valuation. And so now inviting, okay. Sarah should be going. Rich, can you hear me?
I can, Al. Can you hear me?
I can.
Excellent.
But I'm worried I'm going to now get too much echo, so I'll be very quick. If you give me an appraisal today, how long is it good for?
As I've said at your events in the past, first of all, Al, thanks for holding this, and hopefully you'll do this more often. Bill, and Emmanuel, Steve, sorry, have all done an excellent job. Hopefully you'll do what you've done in the corporate space and hold these more regularly. It's a great get together. I also want to comment that a number of us have been hit by the virus, whether it's employees had the virus, the folks on the call. I congratulate you on surviving that sort of thing, and our hearts go out to you as well. So appraisals, I think, are good for 15 minutes. They're snapshots, and then things happen. And I use 9/11 as an example, where things went in half and the like. And I agree with Sarah. We're doing lots of appraisals. There's a lot of financial reporting, impairment, things that are going on and the like. There's a bevy of activity. There are a lot of phone calls, people trying to get a handle on things. I'm an appraiser. I'm not a virologist. And I'm not quite sure when things will end. It might be 2 months from now, or might be 2 years from now. I note that I was planning on going to the Australia Open for tennis in January. And in the press, Australia is saying they're off limits till late next year. So if I'm in the helicopter space and I'm taking people out to the 12 Apostles, I'm probably not doing much. But back to your question, I think we're all valuing things, and our values might be limited to short periods of time.
Mm-hmm. David Crick, can you hear me?
I can, Al. How are you?
Very well. Welcome to David Crick, founder of DavAir. Sorry, you're back as well.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Dave.
This is nice. We've got you reunited. David, what are you seeing at the moment?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. It's the market is as Al and Bill and many others have said, there's definitely a distinction between what was happening last year around this time, year on year, and also towards the end of last year. There's definitely a decrease in the number of transactions and the amount of interest. But we've got to keep in mind, though, that fixed-wing aircraft are usually, if they're a corporate jet, they're a discretionary spend in the most part. And if they're a commercial jet, they're usually specifically for moving passengers or freight. And when we talk about helicopters, we've really got to talk about them as a tool of trade or as a mission asset. And each mission is separate. And as has been said before, the oil and gas mission might be different to the EMS, might be different to cargo or search and rescue. So each market is behaving separately and differently. And we're finding that there is an amount of activity for transactions, and there is an amount of activity from the finance and the leasing community asking about what the future looks like. And those questions are very different to what's its value now. Because the value of a helicopter now is not the same as the value of a helicopter in the future.
Sorry, do you agree with everything David's saying? Okay. Rich, do you agree with everything David's saying? Hello? Is this too ambitious? David, can you hear me?
I can. Yep.
Okay. Do you agree with what you were saying?
Most of it. I think at the end of the day, there's a whole lot of issues that need to be taken into account. You know, who's asking for the valuation and why are they asking for it? The first question a valuer needs to ask is, what's the question I'm having to answer and who am I having to answer that question for? So if it's a lessor with a leasing portfolio that has an active asset, it might be different to someone having an asset that is being repossessed or doesn't have a contract associated with it. So it might have a different value profile compared to what it's doing.
Rich, any comments?
David was spot on. I think as appraisers, we have to parse our words and that maybe we can't be out inspecting assets as readily or companies don't want us on site. The other day, somebody mentioned they were doing some work in yellow iron. And they went out with a drone and crashed the drone into the yellow iron. So our intentions are not to destroy the asset, but to appraise it and the like. So we're running into some difficulties there.
Although presumably if an appraiser damages an asset, they can tell you exactly how much value it's lost straight
correct.
Away.
Yes. If I've run a $50 drone into a helicopter, I can pretty much tell you the damage, it's $50.
Okay, exciting times. Crispin, executive chairman of LCI, has used an emoji, which is a great sign of evolution going on. this is a really great opportunity to share market observations. However, I would just remark that from LCI's own recent experience over the past couple of months, while there might be some slight distress in certain sectors, overall, the helicopter market, particularly for liquid popular types, is holding reassuringly firm. Anyone would like to comment on that?
I actually agree because we have had quite a number of projects where we're dealing with helicopters that are doing power line inspections or helicopters that are doing search and rescue or EMS. And they're reasonably buoyant. I mean, if you're looking at the tourism sector, as Rich said before, there's obviously not as much activity as has been in the past. But at this point in time, there hasn't necessarily been transactions to quantify and solidify a decrease in value. So at this point in time, there's not necessarily a decrease in value. There might be a decrease in activity.
So I don't know if you can hear me. I can't hear you guys at all. Someone's told me to plug in and my mic and plug it back in again. So I'm doing that.
We can hear you.
I think the comment on Crispin's statements, I largely agree with that. I think if we look at the COVID-19 issue as a short-term issue, I do think that we're going to come out of this perhaps largely similar than where we started before the COVID-19 issue. But I think there's two different issues that we're looking at. When we talk about the future value of helicopters as well, I think we need to look at the changing market ahead and what the forces are that might come into play. For an example, we've seen the use of drones being fast forwarded during this epidemic. We've also had more reliance on technology ourselves, which might well tread over the hurdle of public acceptance of technology in general, and that could possibly speed up some incentives in that area. So I think we need to understand the demand drivers for the industry and understand how those can be affected moving forward.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Sarah. I'm going to let you go now so you don't have to worry about technology. Rich, any more comments?
Yeah, Al, I agree totally with Crispin's comment. When I was asking Bill, leasing companies, many of them are diversified. In terms of their holdings and the like, and I think that's a good thing. The a lot of the helicopters on lease are not being operated, and so they're in a lot of maintenance is being done currently, and then in addition, they're not getting a lot of flight hours. So I think that's important. I think as an industry, I use an analogy between the U.S. airlines and the U.S. restaurant industry. If you like restaurants in the U.S., 60% are never coming back. The ones that are coming back have made an adjustment to delivering food and the like. In the U.S. airline industry, I would forecast they'll all file bankruptcy within 14 months, restructure. I'm more concerned about the feeders into the industry, and I would be the same in this industry. Companies feeding in are there'll be a lot of those that will collapse and be absorbed. Maybe we'll be more efficient in kind of looking at how Hoonan had viewed this. They'll probably be more efficient operators.
Okay, thanks, Rich, for that cheery remark to end on. Thank you. David, can you give us something? You're an upbeat, cheery person. Can you give us something upbeat to end on?
I think everything is not as bad as in other sectors of aviation. You know, the commercial aircraft world is in a world of pain. The corporate jet world is in a little bit of pain. I think the helicopter world is not as bad as it could be. And I think, as we've said, there's nothing yet to crystallize too much of a decrease in value. We're being asked by some financiers to say, you know, can you give us a view on what the helicopters might be worth now and what they might be worth when the market bounces? The only thing we can't answer in that, I think, is when will it bounce?